You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 128 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, the home of the Pelton Cast.
And a bit of a somber Pelton Cast here. We have to begin with the news from today of Seahawk and Blazer owner Paul Allen's passing. And I think to begin the show, we have to pour one out for Paul Allen.
Absolutely. I mean, not shocking news because of the fact that he had recently announced that he was again battling non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which he successfully beat in 2009, but certainly surprising that came earlier this month. I don't think anyone realized that he was this close to the end, and very sad to see that news come across the wire today.
And we'll talk about Paul in a little bit more at the end as we talk about the Seahawks. But first, we have to toast to the person who made the Seahawks, who raised the flag every single time they hosted an NFC Championship game. And in all three of those games, they advanced to the Super Bowl. We have to toast to Paul.
Absolutely. A great legacy in terms of his ownership in the Seahawks, among many other things, in terms of impact in the city of Seattle. And we are toasting with the Fremont Mod Pod IPA. The Mod Pod IPA, which is new, honors our three pods of southern resident orca whales living full-time in the Puget Sound, the J, K, and L pods, currently numbering 78 whales. Our whales are a treasure worthy of reflection and thought. In particular, we think of Granny, J2, who is the leader of the J, K, and L pods, and is considered to have been the oldest orca in the world when she passed away in 2016 after 107 years of gracing our waters. Granny was the matriarch of the southern resident community, and we brew Mod Pod IPA in her honor. Enjoy and observe.
God, Fremont, they could do no wrong.
Yeah.
Oh.
Really, really adds to the somber element.
This is the perfect beer to be drinking in this moment.
Yes. That's quite smooth.
Before we get to discussing Paul and his legacy a little bit further, though, let's talk about Shake Shack.
Yeah, we start with an opening of Shake Shack last Thursday in Seattle after the brief 5-day delay. And judging by the line when we went last Friday night, tried to go, is popular as expected.
Yeah, Shake Shack's popular.
It was a line all the way down the block along Westlake.
I mean, I think Friday night was kind of, because it opened on
Thursday morning, 11 a.m.
Is that right? No.
Yeah. It was Thursday.
Thursday, okay. So Friday night was kind of the time for all the Shake Shack fans to go. You have your night out. Shake Shack was the occasion.
Absolutely.
What have we heard as far as Shake Shack's opening so far?
Well, third Pelton brother, Nate Takert, made a visit to Shake Shack last, I think this was Thursday, and gave us a little bit of advice on what's going on there, in addition to saying some scandalous things about it.
But what's going on there?
So he said that there was barely a line. He went at 3:30 on, this was on Friday, or on, no, this was on Thursday, on opening day. And at that point, barely a line, according to him. Not surprising. I think this is going to be a really trendy lunch spot and then maybe weekend evenings. But if you go outside of that, possibly not as busy. He said he was through the line in 6 minutes. His review, again, I'm going to skip through the in-and-out slander.
Wow.
A fast line with kiosks, I should say. But if that's long, there's a separate line for cash only in the back for a possible sneak, potential sneak.
I like that. I like the sneak potential. It's only a sneak potential for you because you're the only person in the world who carries cash.
That's accurate. That's fair. I'm the only person under the age of 50 who carries cash.
There are people in the service industry who I think carry cash often also.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I'm not saying that as any sort of like euphemism. I mean literally in the service industry.
Yes. Yes, people who get tips.
Yes.
We haven't checked this out yet because of the fact that the line was so long on Friday night when we went. At some point here in the near future,
I went to Shake Shack like a week and a half ago.
It's true.
And like I'm sure it's pretty similar to the one in New York.
You could always get the Northwest double, Shack Northwest double or whatever.
Didn't sound that good.
That's true.
I'm probably going to get a double Shack burger.
It's great. Cheese fries.
And we tried. We gave it an investigation.
We efforted it.
Sure, we competed our hardest. But also at the same time, we may discuss on a Talkin' Taco Time, maybe even this week. You know, there's a lot of great things happening in Seattle, so we don't necessarily need that much hoopla around Shake Shack.
It's true.
And, you know, the comparison that I made was, do you remember a few things that have opened? First off, do you remember when IKEA opened?
I really don't remember that, no.
Four or five major openings that I recall, all of which, so there was IKEA.
Still very popular.
No, IKEA's crazy, all the time.
Not all the time. I've got some IKEA sneaks.
IKEA sneaks? Well, did they still have that $1 like breakfast that they had?
Actually, you know what the real IKEA sneak is? You go in the back and just go in the warehouse and pick out what you have because you figure out where it is online.
But you don't have the fun of walking through IKEA.
But you don't have the horror of walking through
IKEA. You're playing yourself because walking through IKEA is so much fun. Second off, Trader Joe's opening in Burien. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
There was some huge fanfare around that. And you know what? Still a lot of people at the Trader Joe's in Burien.
I've heard some things about Trader Bros possibly being on the way.
Oh, wow.
Whew. Can you confirm or deny those rumors?
Oh, my gosh. I'm fanning myself. I'm so excited. If Trader Bros is actually coming. Let's just say we need to get a Trader Bros in before pumpkin season is over.
Okay. That does put a timeline on it.
Next up, Krispy Kreme donuts.
Now, this I 100% remember, the craziness. And I had been to Krispy Kreme before it came to Seattle. When I took a trip to LA after my senior year of high school, we went to a Dodgers game. They threw a shutout. And with your ticket, you were, because of the fact that they threw a shutout, got a half dozen Krispy Kreme donuts.
Wow, a half dozen.
I crushed a lot of Krispy Kreme donuts on that trip.
Maybe a half dozen? Well, it's no, got to say hot.
But there was a lot of us there, and I don't know if everyone ate their full half dozen. So I probably consumed more than a half dozen.
You were competing in that moment.
I was competing my hardest.
The last one is Sonic Drive-In.
You're not going to count Chick-fil-A?
Okay, I'll go through ahead. Go ahead and include Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A actually is probably the most comparable because there are multiple Krispy Kremes in the greater Northwest area. You could go to Krispy Kreme at almost any time, walk right up to the counter and get a donut.
Yeah, the Krispy Kreme to hoopla died down very fast.
Chick-fil-A, I don't know if I want to say that there's hoopla. There actually are multiple Chick-fil-A's now.
Yes.
In the greater Seattle area.
And they are all still very busy.
I've told you this. I don't think...
You think it's because of the way the parking lot is designed?
I think Chick-fil-A designs their businesses to make them seem busier than they are.
I get what you're saying, but I still think they're busy locations nonetheless.
The thing that I want is... So Chick-fil-A takes a very long time for you to order, but then you get your food relatively quickly.
Correct.
Now, have you noticed... This is another breaking news. Costco has turned entirely to kiosks. Or at least at some locations.
I am aware of this fact.
So what that means is you order your food quickly, but you don't necessarily get it right away.
Okay.
There's two different ways to approach this, which is, would you rather stand in line or would you rather loiter?
I don't know if I have a strong feeling about this. The act of waiting in line, I speak from waiting in a line at Salt and Straw in Portland a couple weeks ago. Mm. Not that bad if you're just like having a conversation with someone.
Okay. What if you hate everybody around you?
Oh, yeah.
You can also have a conversation after you order.
That's true.
There's no difference.
It's somehow like more pleasant than the walking through the line if you've got someone else with you. Whereas I think that just standing there waiting is slightly more pleasant if you're scrolling through your phone. So if I'm alone, I want the kiosk. If I'm with someone, with a group of people, I want the line.
I almost always want to order quickly and wait for my food for a long time.
Okay.
I think is what I prefer. Because you feel like you've done something.
Yes.
It seems like your food is going to come faster. It was the same at Egg Slot in Vegas.
Yes, you've mentioned that. That is accurate.
Where I guess both kind of took a long time. No. You wait a little while, but then your food comes relatively quickly. It's just a different way of designing things, and that's what Chick-fil-A is. But what I'm saying is that the Shake Shack fervor is going to die down. Honestly, there will be another Shake Shack within 2 years in the city of Seattle.
You think so?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's necessarily their model. I think they want one location in a lot of places.
There will be a second Shake Shack in the city of Seattle.
Is this an official bold prediction?
Bold prediction.
Okay. All right.
We have no means of revisiting this like we do in the end of the year pod, but
I'll just I'm just going to put it up and then, you know what? I'll write a Google note to myself 2 years from now. I've done that. I've been known to do that from time to time. I'm a horrible person.
But it's interesting that Shake Shack opened. I don't know if I'm desperate to go to Shake Shack.
I want to go there to say that I've been.
You've been to Shake Shack.
But not to Shake Shack Seattle. And we do a podcast about Seattle food.
Okay.
It feels somewhat incomplete to not have gone to Shake Shack Seattle.
That's the reason this podcast feels incomplete?
Well, touche. Really, really own burn there.
We'll be there soon, I'm sure.
I'm confident of it. Anything else in this?
No.
It's time for the return of an annual tradition. The 2018-19 NBA season tips off tonight.
Wow.
When the Celtics face the 76ers and the Warriors face the Rockets? I don't know. I haven't actually looked at the schedule.
Look, you don't know that much about basketball. I'm going to have to tell you about it.
Fill me in about it, please. No,
this is the segment where I tell you what's going on with basketball players from Seattle, players to watch for the year. You understand, oh, okay. Right?
That'll be exciting. I look forward to hearing it.
So anyway,
Thunder and the Warriors.
Yusuf Nurkic.
Oh, good. So I annually come up with 10 obscure NBA players for you to watch over the course of the season. And then you, of course, do not watch them whatsoever.
Never once discuss them again.
And then midway through the season,
I guess part of this was Malcolm Brogdon.
Part of this, I was supposed to go back and look up the 2017-18 list, which we did do talk about at one point around the All-Star break, if I recall correctly. But I don't think I've gotten back to since then. So I need to go look that up. All right, here's last year's list.
Let's hear it.
John Collins of the Atlanta Hawks.
Never heard of him.
Who ended up being one of the most valuable rookies. Justin Holiday.
Oh, hello.
We're going to talk about him in a minute because we're going to talk about UW players, so he doesn't need to be on this list. Juancho Hernan Gomez.
Was he good?
No. He had mono early in the season. It was a rough year for him. Jordan Bell with the Warriors, who ended up playing an important role for them in the playoffs. Joe Chi of the Rockets, who barely played at all.
Joe Chi?
Yes. He's Chinese.
But still, I don't even recognize. It's funny that we went through this last year and I still don't know these players. Of course not.
Milos Teodosic of the Clippers.
I was going to say Teodosic better be on there.
He was like the ultimate player for you to watch. Thon Maker of the Bucks, who had kind of a disappointing second season. Frank Ntilikina of the Knicks.
How is he? Is he bad?
He's not good offensively.
That's what I've heard.
He's probably a role player.
One of the worst offensive point guards ever.
Yeah, that's up there. Jonathan Isaac of the Magic, who had suffered through a number of injuries, didn't really do much as a rookie. And then Donovan Mitchell. He ended up being too prominent. I did not put anyone as prominent as Donovan Mitchell on this year's list.
You don't know.
Well, okay. But Donovan Mitchell was the 13th pick in the draft. There's no one who was as high a draft pick as him. I've gone more obscure than
there
year.
We go. That's got what back the opposite gotta direction. Give the people what they want.
Okay. So we start this list year's list in Brooklyn.
Are we going through the 10 players to watch or Northwest/Husky players?
We're going to go to 10 players to watch and then we'll do Husky.
Okay,
players.
Let's hear it.
With I need to look up how to double check how to pronounce his name.
That's how you know it's a good one.
Rodions Kurucs of the Brooklyn Nets. A second round pick by them, number 40 overall. He played last year sparingly for FC Barcelona. He's from Latvia, like Kristaps Porzingis, the other Latvian gangbanger. In the preseason, in 48 minutes of action, he had 31 points, 18 rebounds, and 6 steals.
Wow.
So I don't know if he's actually going to play, but there's a decent chance that he puts up numbers if he does play.
Really? Yeah. Why would he not play if he's on the Nets?
They're good now.
Are they actually good?
They're like my sneaky playoff contender pick.
Do they want to make the playoffs?
If they can make the playoffs, they want to make the playoffs, probably.
It's
If not, they'll trade all the veterans and they'll probably play Rodions.
I feel like if I'm a Nets fan, like granted, going to the playoffs is fun, but the Nets have kind of had the worst of both worlds.
They really have.
They're good by the time they get their draft pick back.
They're okay. I mean, look, they're not going to... I mean, if they sneak into the playoffs, it's going to be the 8th seed. It's going to be the 15th
pick. Not worth being good.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
All right, next on my list, David Nwaba of the Cleveland Cavaliers.
I know that name.
He played for Chicago last year, played for the Lakers briefly the year before that. Probably one of the more unlikely NBA players in recent memory. He played at Cal Poly, which had never previously produced an NBA player.
Really?
Under former Seattle U coach and Seattle area native Joe Calero at Cal Poly. I would say if I had to compare, if I were like a super athletic player my game would be a lot like David Nwaba.
I pity David Nwaba.
He's not really a shooter. Just runs, he just plays so hard. And because of the fact that he is, in fact, super athletic, he gets a lot done. So he's fun to watch. He's on Cleveland this year. They need some minutes on the wing. I don't know if you've heard LeBron left.
He's a wing player.
He is.
Okay.
He's like a 6'6" shooting guard, small forward. Huh. Even he's kind of got the skill set of a power forward.
That's you.
Exactly.
Except you play more in the post.
Well, just because I can't. I'm an even worse shooter than he is.
Okay.
Okay, next up, Monty Morris, who is going to be playing this year in large part because of the lack of availability of someone we'll get to in a moment. That being Isaiah Thomas.
Oh, I thought he was going to be on the Spurs.
No, he's on the Nuggets.
Can I guess what team these players are on?
Yeah, okay, yeah, who he played for. Monty Morris was number 15 overall in my 2017 draft projections and number 3 in the stats-only projections.
Really?
Yeah, he's this year's Fred VanVleet.
Oh, man, that's a bold prediction.
That is a bold prediction, but he's played well during the preseason.
The Nuggets are good at drafting.
So he was on because they always draft guys I like.
Okay.
He was on a two-way contract for them last year as a rookie. This year he's on a full NBA contract, and he's going to be their backup point guard at the start of the season.
Was he good last year on his two-way contract?
I mean, he didn't play much in the NBA. They had...
Was he good in the G League?
Yeah.
On the Denver...
He wasn't, like, outstanding.
Are they in Fort Collins? Boulder? They're in Boulder.
I'm not sure off the top of my head. They're not in Boulder, though. I can tell you that.
They're like the Boulder Miners.
You stumped me on that one. Okay, next up, Javon Carter.
Wait, what? I am supposed to guess what team? You're supposed to guess.
How long is this going to take?
Well, I'm only going to guess one team and then tell you if I'm right or wrong.
Okay.
I'm going to guess he's on the Heat.
That is incorrect. He's on the Grizzlies. He is, like, if you were to list what Javon Carter is, he's number one a Grizzlies player, he's number two a Heat player.
There we go. That's what I was thinking, based obviously upon his name.
He was at West Virginia last year. And, like, the most aggressive, best defensive guard in the country. Grizzlies took him early in the second round. He may not play a lot at the start of the year because they signed Shelvin Mack as a backup veteran point guard. But eventually he's going to get his chance, and I think he's going to be fun to watch.
When Will Conroy's injured. Or, sorry, not Will Conroy. Mike Conley. Wow, that was Will way Conroy, off. That is. Hopefully Will Conroy doesn't get injured.
Breaking news. I mean, yes, I hope he doesn't. All right, next in the list, another player who's very fun to watch, in my opinion, Derrick Jones.
Oh, God, I know this
he
one.
He played for this team last year on a two-way contract. Now is, like Monty Morris, on a full NBA contract.
Oh, Derrick Jones.
You probably don't know this.
Phoenix?
He started his career at Phoenix. He is now on the Miami Heat. He is the single best leaper in the entire NBA,
really?
At least relative to its height. Because he's like 6'9" and has super long arms. There is no better dunker in gameplay than Derrick Jones.
Wow.
Constantly dunking.
Has he been in a dunk contest?
He was, I think, as a rookie. Yeah. He didn't do great in the dunk contest, but in game, he's dunking a lot.
The dunk contest is all about flair.
All right, next up on the list.
It's a popularity contest.
Christian Wood.
Oh, God. I'm going to guess he's on the Timberwolves.
All right, that's close. Also, you could probably get some context clues for the fact that these are alphabetical by team. He is on the Milwaukee Bucks. Made the roster at the end of training camp. He was partially guaranteed at the start of camp. He's always had these great per-minute stats and been a huge favorite of statistical analysts. Sam Hinkie was keeping him around at the end of the Sixers bench when he was still in charge of the Sixers. And then as soon as Jerry Colangelo came in, they cut him and instead signed Elton Brand.
Players with bigger collars. They signed Elton Brand to be the GM.
Who is now the GM of the Sixers. It's a weird franchise. But Wood made the Bucks. He looked awesome during the preseason. He's probably better right now than Thon Maker is.
Oh, man.
Yeah. That might not be saying much, though.
Shots to your 2017 players to watch.
They have Brooke Lopez. They have a real center now, but I would like to see Christian Wood emerge as their backup center. All right, next up on the list, Mitchell Robinson.
Now I'm just trying to go through the league alphabetically. I'm going to guess he's on the Knicks.
That is correct.
Yes.
With that context clue, you got it. Robinson was a second-round pick this year, another standout in my projections, someone who did not play any college basketball. He originally signed to play at Western Kentucky because of his mentor, Shamond Williams.
There we go.
But then Shamond Williams, for inexplicable reasons, left the coaching staff. And Mitchell Robinson did not play
Shamond Williams
last
year. Was on the coaching staff at Western Kentucky?
He was, yeah.
Huh. Isn't there a Shamond Williams fan club Twitter or Instagram?
That sounds right. Okay. That follows us? I think they do. Anyway,
Shouts to Shamon Williams.
His AAU stats were really amazing, and he looked really good during the summer league for the Knicks. Got a chance to be a draft steal this year, I would say. All right, next on the list. I've gone to the wrong list. Hamidou Diallo, someone I tweeted about last week.
He's on the Thunder.
He is on the Oklahoma City
Thunder. You told me that.
Yeah. Out of Kentucky, and wasn't very good at Kentucky, but he looked good during summer league and great during the preseason. So he might play some minutes right away for the Thunder, who need him because Andre Robertson is injured, going to miss the first couple months of the season. As we've discussed, a devastating blow to the Thunder that Andre Robertson and his elite defense is out of the lineup. All right, next up, someone you may have seen during his freshman year at USC, DeAnthony Melton.
Oh, what team is he on?
Who he play for?
On the Suns.
He is on the Suns. Got drafted by the Houston Rockets in the second round, but was traded to the Suns as part of the Ryan Anderson, Brandon Knight trade.
Is he a center?
Also Marquise Chris trade. We'll also get to it. No, he's a combo guard. He's very Marcus Smartish.
Okay.
Didn't play last year because he was caught up in the Adidas investigation. Allegations that relation to him took money, so he wasn't eligible to play last year. Great defensive guard, questionable offense and shooter, but the Suns have really nothing at point guard other than now they've signed someone who we're going to talk about in a minute here. But, you know, if he plays well, he's got a chance to play a lot as a rookie.
All right. I think the Suns are going to be fun.
I don't know if they're going to be fun. They're going to be really bad on defense.
That makes a fun team. Bad on defense. Oh, they're going to be really bad on defense. They're going to be athletic. They're going to score a ton of points. We'll hate watching them.
They're not going to score that many points. In my RPM projections out today on ESPN Insider, the Phoenix Suns, the worst projection in the NBA.
Wow. What about... Okay, get through your players and I'll ask you about some top rookies.
All right. Lastly, Derek White.
Sacramento.
Really a lot of connections here to our Seattle/UW list we're going to get to in a second. Derek White is going to be the Spurs starter.
Oh, he's the person who got injured after DeJounte got injured.
Yes, he suffered
a
torn plantar fascia and will miss the next 6 to 8 weeks. But when he comes back, will play an important role. Looked really good in preseason, despite my initial skepticism watching him at the Salt Lake, Utah Jazz Summer League. Okay. Get to your questions.
So some of the players who were drafted near the top of the draft, how have they been playing so far during preseason?
Ayton has been really dominant during the preseason.
Really? DeAndre
Ayton, the number one overall pick. Yeah. He was kind of disappointing during summer league. He was just okay during summer league, but he's been great during the preseason. Doncic, everyone's raving about him.
He's playing amazing.
He's Luka Doncic, man. He's going to be great.
You could say his name like that. Yeah. He's that good. God. I'm not
best
a Suns
fan. Projection ever.
How did they not draft Luka Doncic?
I mean, the real question is how did the Kings not draft Luka Doncic?
Well, I'm kind of happy about that.
Fair.
The Kings are number two on the teams that I cheer against for some reason.
Marvin Bagley has had some moments, but not overall.
He was a bust the moment he was drafted. Marvin Bagley is like the type of player, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, where they talk about the minute you drive a car off the lot, it's worth half as much. That's Marvin Bagley the minute he was drafted.
I mean, that's the number two pick, yes, because someone else could have traded for it and used it to draft Doncic.
Yes. They could not trade Marvin Bagley right now for whoever was like the eighth pick in the draft.
They probably could trade him for the eighth pick in the draft. I don't know, maybe not, actually.
So Doncic has been amazing. What about Trae Young?
Trae Young hit a 35-footer from the edge of the Georgia Tech logo to win a preseason game, so that was fun. His shooting percentages have been low. They're going to be low, but he shows great court vision. He's fun to watch.
So he's going to be okay.
Jaren Jackson's been really terrific. He looks like he's going to be just a very solid NBA player for many, many years to come.
What about Wendell Carter with the Bulls?
Yeah, he's probably going to start, it looks like, at some point. If not at the start of the season, then very close to it over Robin Lopez.
If you had to choose, and Jaren Jackson on the Grizzlies, if you had to choose one player from the back end of the lottery or later in the first round, your Donovan Mitchell type, who's somebody who's going to be competing for Rookie of the Year despite not being drafted in like the top 10?
I mean, the answer is probably nobody, because I think that, among other things, well, Ben Simmons was really good last year, so maybe that doesn't quite apply. If you forced me to pick someone...
I mean, this is a podcast, and I asked you, so that's basically forcing you.
I don't know. I just don't think there's anyone, really, that has that combination of opportunity and skill. I mean, I might be crazy enough to say Mitchell Robinson, but even he's blocked by Enes Kanter. So
what about players from the later in the draft that you think are going to be good this year?
Good this year?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's that many of them. I mean, there's not the like obvious like Josh Hart kind of players in this year's draft. I don't think like Diallo is mentioned. Someone who's looked pretty good. We'll see if that's a better indicator than the fact that he wasn't very good in college. I mean, just a lot of guys I don't think are going to play very much as rookies.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay, and what about Northwest players?
All right. We got an extensive list. We start with the aforementioned Justin Holliday.
Not many of them are playing.
Who is starting again at small forward for the Bulls because Jabari Parker is now back at power forward instead of playing small forward. So, good news there for Justin Holliday. His teammate in Chicago, Zach LaVine, the Bothell product, signed a 4-year, $78 million contract this summer, an offer sheet by the Kings that the Bulls match. He's looked very good offensively during the preseason. I still have a lot of issues about his defense, but offensively quite productive. Isaiah Thomas, we mentioned, no timetable for his return as yet from that second hip surgery that ended his 2017-18 season. So that's kind of discouraging. The Nuggets also have Michael Porter, the Nathan Hale product, who is also out for an uncertain period of time after he underwent a second back surgery after the Nuggets.
The Nuggets are all about players from Seattle with severe surgeries.
Yeah. Marquese Chris is mentioned, is with the Rockets, and this is looking like it's going to be the perfect fit for Marquese.
Really?
Chris. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're just lobbing the ball to him all the time for dunks.
Really? Oh, this
He's
I like.
Switching. It's like so much. Like he went to the absolute wrong place for him in Phoenix. I don't know for sure that it's going to work for him in Houston, but what I do know is if it's going to work for him anywhere, it's going to be in Houston.
Sure, that's probably true of a lot of players.
Yes.
But so he's not playing around the perimeter in Houston. He's playing as the five. Little,
occasionally, but yeah,
is
they're
he,
using him as
a center.
He's
still a pretty bad shooter.
He's got nice touch, but he just doesn't make a high enough percentage that you want him out there. You'd rather him like be rolling to the basket.
And so is he playing center with four other guards when he's playing?
Yeah.
So he's basically like Clint Capela off the bench?
Yeah.
Wow. Look at Marquese Chris.
He's mini Clint Capela now.
I would love to see Marquese Chris turn into a good player.
It would be fun. All right, CJ Wilcox is with the Pacers on a two-way contract technically, but he suffered a ruptured Achilles during off-season workouts and is out for the season. His star-crossed NBA career in terms of injuries continues.
Man.
Has not played an NBA game in the last 2 years here. Markelle Fultz starting for the 76ers at this point, although it seems like that experiment may not be long for the world.
Really?
He ended up going 1 of 5 on threes in the Ooh. Preseason.
At least he hit one.
Yeah. So what the Sixers, what Brett Brown started doing at the end of their trip to China was playing J.J. Redick to start the second half instead of Markelle Fultz.
Okay.
So that kind of feels like that's going to happen at the start of the first half at some point before long here.
Who, with Simmons as the point guard?
Yes.
It's just... Is Markelle Fultz a good NBA player right now?
I mean, he showed a lot of skills in his rookie season despite the non-shooting, so if he could shoot effectively, the answer is probably yes.
There's basically just no point guard, maybe aside from Frank Ntilikina that you're talking about, who... could be worse for Markelle Fultz to play opposite than Ben Simmons, right?
Yeah, there's not a lot. And even Ntilikina started making threes.
It's just such a bad situation for him.
Yeah.
So they kind of need to be in opposite lineups.
I mean, they want them eventually to be in the same line. And first off, Simmons is going to play enough. You want Fultz to play. They're going to have to play together.
How is Markelle's shooting looking aside from threes?
I mean, he seems reasonably comfortable shooting pull-ups. That was never a huge issue for him.
The Hezzy Jimbo or whatever?
Yes.
Pull-up Jimbo?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, next up, Quincy Pond. Or no, I guess I skipped over DeJounte Murray, who, as we alluded to earlier, suffered a torn ACL in the preseason. Very disappointing. He was a trendy pick for most improved player. The Spurs were raving about his improvement as a shooter. So real bummer there for both the Spurs and DeJounte Murray. The Spurs also have Quincy Pondexter, who made the roster after playing sparingly last season in Chicago, coming back from the knee surgeries and infection that cost him 2 full years playing in New Orleans.
He feels like a Spursy kind of player.
He does. I'm just not convinced he's an NBA-level contributor at this point, but they apparently see it. So one player we thought at one point might go to San Antonio was Jamal Crawford.
Hmm.
But he remained unsigned until Monday.
Really?
when, according to reports, he signed a contract with the Phoenix Suns.
Okay.
Where he will, I guess, be playing opposite Devin Booker.
On their playoff push?
You know, he's veteran leadership.
There's just no team that needs Jamal Crawford less than the Suns.
It's not the particular fit, I would say.
He should have signed with the Lakers or something.
I think he would have loved to sign with the Lakers.
And they just didn't want him.
It didn't. It was not that much interest in Jamal this offseason.
That's too bad.
I mean, he's been around a long time. So that's the full list of Seattle slash UW players.
Okay, and what about the Blazers going into their season? Last year, they were the 3 seed in the West, ended up being swept in the first round by the Pelicans.
They're now a trendy pick to miss the playoffs.
Has there been a year that the Blazers are not a trendy pick to miss the playoffs?
Fair question. Probably not since LaMarcus Aldridge was there.
Every single year, they just say, oh, the Blazers can't make the playoffs or whatever. And they always outperform expectations.
They do. I mean, there was...
Haters are gonna hate.
I mean, yeah. They outperformed expectations last year, that's for sure.
What was their point differential? Where did that rank them?
I mean, it was right in there. They didn't dramatically outperform their point differential.
So then what?
But there was 3 games difference, let's be clear, between third seed and out of the playoffs.
Sure.
So it's a thin margin. And when you lose, you know, quality reserves at Davis, Shabazz Napier, Pat Connaughton.
That is not why people are saying this, though. You know that's...
Well, I mean, it's because they got swept, but that's also...
It's because they got swept and because they're the Blazers, and this shit happens every year.
They also are depending a lot on Evan Turner.
A lot. Well, I don't know how I feel about that.
They're running their second unit through Evan Turner. But they're getting started with the Lakers. That's going
to
be interesting.
We're talking about this while there's the In Memoriam on Monday Night Football to Paul Allen happening right now.
Yeah, it's
kind of intense.
Unfortunate timing.
But maybe the Blazers will have a good season again and outperform their expectations again.
Yeah.
Do they have... And also, you're not talking about Zach Collins having a more prominent role within the...
He will have a more prominent role. Myers Leonard also will have a more prominent role.
Zach Collins is good.
Zach Collins shows promise. He doesn't look great statistically.
Did they add anybody this offseason?
Seth Curry.
Yeah, Seth Curry.
Nick Stauskas.
Good addition.
Yeah.
Seth Curry's such a Blazers player, too.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I think you're underrating the Blazers, like you people do every year.
I mean, for my sake, it's better if the Blazers are good, so I hope so.
Okay, and then what about the Lakers?
So your
RPM projections, you said, came out today.
The Lakers have now slid ahead of the Blazers into 8th. Both of those teams better than 50-50 to make the playoffs, which is why worrying about who's 8th and who's 9th is silly.
They're better than 50-50 because there are so many teams that are in various percentages of making the playoffs.
Yeah, and really now there's with San Antonio's injuries, there's a big drop-off after the top 9 in the West. It's really 9 teams for 8 spots. And if you think that the Wolves are going to trade Jimmy Butler, then their chances are probably even better than... You know, even if you think they're only as good as the RPM projections say they are, their chances are still better. No, I said if you think they're better.
Okay.
Which everyone else thinks. Literally everyone else.
What do you think not looking at the RPM projections?
I think they look really good in transition during the preseason. They look not as good, not transition.
If you had to do a non-RPM projection top 8, what would it be? 8 seeds in the Western Conference.
I mean, in terms of order?
Just your own prediction.
I do think Portland is 9th if Minnesota keeps Jimmy Butler. I think the Lakers are probably more like a 46-win team than the 41 or 42 that RPM says.
Okay, which puts them where?
6th through 8th.
Okay.
Maybe 5th.
And so... Denver's in. Utah's in. Yeah. You still think Utah is one of the top 3 teams in the West?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah. And I think something I wrote about last week on ESPN Insider, this year's like rules point of education or point of emphasis was the old term for this, is freedom of movement in terms of off-ball contact. And I think that's going to benefit the Jazz quite a bit. You know, it benefits teams that have a lot of movement away from the ball in their offense, and that's something the Jazz really like to emphasize, they've been kind of working for this for a long period of time, agitating for it.
That's all they needed was some offense, some defense, and some rule changes.
Hey, and they got the offense and defense last year, and now they got the rule changes.
Good for them.
There you go.
Anything else we should look for heading into this NBA season?
I think that's the main thing we've covered. We've talked about a long period of time.
All right. So should we pivot back to Seattle sports?
Let's pivot back to Seattle sports, starting with the Sounders, who are coming off an international break last weekend and heading into the penultimate week of the MLS, the lengthy, the interminable MLS regular season, with a pair of matches this week. They will come back from the break Wednesday at Orlando City, and then Sunday face Houston, who they just defeated 4-1 in their previous game before the international break. This is, again, an opportunity for the Sounders to score some points in the standings. Orlando City has the second worst rating, according to 538's football power index, or soccer power index, I should say, and just one MLS win since May 6th. Houston actually has played reasonably well this season, but we saw when they were missing a couple of their starters due to international duty, but the Sounders obviously dominated them at home, and this is a team that really has nothing to play for at this point of the season, long eliminated from the playoff race. So, you know, I think the expectation for the Sounders going into this week was that they come away with 4 points, a win and a draw, and a reasonable chance, even playing on the road in both these matches, of getting a pair of wins, which is important. They are still in fifth, 1 point back of Portland with a match in hand over the Timbers, 4 points up on Real Salt Lake for sixth. They can clinch a playoff spot with a win in either of these two matchups, and then they are 3 points back of Sporting Kansas City for third place, having played an equal number of matches to Sporting KC.
And really just making the playoffs would be incredible considering where they were 2 months ago.
Absolutely. But as we've talked about ad nauseum, the goal at this point is to get up into fourth, host that first round playoff matchup, which looks like it would likely be against a derby match against the Timbers. So really important, I think, to get home field and that crowd and that matchup where the crowd is so important. So a big week for the Sounders. We'll know a lot more about where they're headed at the end of this week. We turn now to Husky football. And I think it's time for the return of a segment we haven't had in a while.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
All right, you know where we're going with this, right? Why did the Huskies settle for a 37-yard field goal at the end of regulation? And I think I, for one, was especially frustrated by the explanation from Coach Pete after the game that part of the logic was, oh, we're already in field goal range and we didn't have a good play here, which would maybe be acceptable, except for the fact that they had two timeouts to take to consider what might have been a good play. Now, I want to grant to Coach Pete that part of the difficulty here was it was a weird situation because, kind of similar to Super Bowl 49 in the end of that game that got canceled, the other team should have been taking timeout. It was a huge mistake by Mario Cristobal not to call timeout. And if Peyton Henry had made that kick at the end of the game, what Oregon fans would be complaining about right now, they would be having their own area of grievances about why didn't Cristobal take timeout so we could have time for a drive after the field goal. But he let the clock tick down from about 40 seconds after the play the Huskies ran to get it to 3rd-and-1. And Coach Pete did not take a timeout at any point there until it got to all the way down to 3 seconds. And at that point, you're just setting up for the final field goal. Now, what I really want to complain about here is the concept of field goal range. If I had one pet peeve about football analysis, it would be people thinking that running backs matter. If I had two pet peeves about football analysis, it would be the way coaches treat fourth downs. Somewhere on that list, I don't know where it would be, but closer to the top than the bottom, would be the concept of field goal range, because it treats it as this binary thing where either you're in field goal range or you're out of field goal range, and there's nothing that matters besides that. But of course, it's probabilistic. The closer you get, the more likely you are to hit the field goal, especially with someone who's a relatively inexperienced kicker, a freshman who has only kicked one kick longer than 37 yards in a game successfully in his life. That being actually earlier in this game against Oregon. Obviously, more yards would have been better, would have helped. But coaches, much like broadcasters, and this whole concept of the field goal line that we see on broadcasts unfortunately serves to reinforce this notion. Like, yes, there is such a thing as field goal range in terms of, like, there's a point at which you shouldn't attempt a field goal whatsoever. And the Huskies followed that during this drive when they went for a 4th-and-3 instead of attempting what would have been a field goal that was outside of Peyton Henry's range in all likelihood. But again, the closer you get, the more likely you are to hit the field goal. And even a few yards would have mattered. I mean, at worst case scenario, even if you wanted to avoid the scenario of Oregon having time left on the clock after a made kick, you work the clock down to about, 10 seconds, 9 seconds, take time out there, then you run a play, and you still have the timeout to use after that play to set up for the field goal. And there's also not such a long delay. You add that in, you add the delay of the Huskies waiting 35 seconds, them calling timeout, 2 Oregon timeouts. It was an extremely long period of time between when the Huskies finished playing football and the Peyton Henry kick. And during every single second of that time, I was thinking that the Huskies were going to miss this kick. I assume you were feeling the same way.
It still haunts me. I mean, I had a pretty good football weekend between fantasy and the Seahawks. Like, I was redeemed. I described my football weekend as like that Alonzo Mourning gift where he's looking, the GIF was Alonzo Mourning's gift to us.
Oh, it really but was.
The Alonzo Mourning GIF where he's like looking really upset and then he's like thinking for a second. And he's like, things are okay. That was my football weekend. But I'm still upset about this loss.
You did say immediately after the game that nothing that happened in the Seahawks game could redeem it.
And I was wrong about that. Well, maybe I wasn't wrong about that. Fantasy football helped redeem it too.
Okay.
But I have my priorities straight. Because I'm back to being good at fantasy football, Benby.
But are you a genius at fantasy football?
We're going to check the points after this week.
I'm happy to check the points.
You're playing in a 10-team league. Can't compare. Anyway... It was 2nd-and-1, right? Or was it 3rd-and-1?
I believe it was 3rd-and-1.
I'm pretty sure it was 2nd-and-1. Not having if it was 2nd-and-1, it's even worse. Like, what does that even mean? You could call any play. You have all the plays to call in that situation. You could hand the ball off. They handed the ball off in the exact same way the entire game, and you could have just done that. Give the ball to McGrew. Let him run it. Maybe it was 3rd-and-1.
It was 3rd-and-1.
But still, they would have picked up a 1st down with the run. And then the concept of like timeouts doesn't even matter. All you need is 1 yard to take away any of those concerns because then you control the clock in that moment.
Yeah. It's also especially weird because they called a timeout between 1st and 2nd down, which implied that they wanted to keep running as many plays as possible.
You make this as easy as possible rather than putting all of the pressure on your freshman kicker. That's it.
Like, college kickers are bad. That's the thing. You should never count on college kickers. Even if it were a closer field goal, I'd still have expected him to miss because college kickers are bad.
Unless you have Justin Tucker or Steven Goskowski out there, you get the ball as far as you can. I'm upset that the Huskies didn't try to score a touchdown on this series. Not that they played for a long field goal. I thought that they would have tried to get as close to the goal line as they can.
I would say what I was reminded of leading up to this kick was the 2012 Apple Cup when Travis Coons missed a kick at the end of regulation and the Huskies lost in overtime as I was driving down to Portland for a Blazers game.
You never win. When you miss that kick, you never come back and win.
I'm pretty sure that doesn't check out mathematically.
Scientifically speaking, no team has ever missed a kick at the end of regulation and then won the game. It just doesn't happen. You knew it wasn't going to happen. The minute he missed that kick, we weren't so upset because he missed it. We were upset because the game was over.
Yes.
And we knew it. We let him off the hook.
They were who we thought they were.
The other thing is the Huskies outplayed
Oregon. I don't know if they were who they thought they were, because actually they were a lot better defensively than I expected.
They were a lot better defensively, but they not as good offensively. They played bad. Oregon played bad in this game.
They played bad?
The Huskies outplayed them in every single facet of the game and still lost.
Is special teams no longer a facet of the game?
They didn't
outplay. Being able to get a kickoff somehow successfully stop someone on a kickoff below the 35, that's not a facet of the game. Win. The one time they forced a fumble after a return to the 40?
There was only one long kick return the entire game.
Yeah, because then they started kicking it really short.
Well, that was a good decision.
It probably was, but that's still giving the ball to Oregon at like the 33.
The Huskies outgained them in this game by a yard and a half per play, and Oregon still won. We let them off the hook. And that's why this game is so frustrating, because we know that the Huskies are a better team. We went into their house and played better than them, and they still get the win.
I mean, they also ran, 81 plays to the Huskies, 70? Because partially because of the fact that they converted 3 of 3 fourth downs. If you count, I mean, they were 9 of 18 on third down, then add the 3 of 3 fourth downs. That's 2/3 of the time when they got to third down, they ended up picking up. That's a lot.
Sure. I've also got a message for Giants fans who think that it was okay to draft Saquon Barkley because this is your quarterback. The dude who's scared to throw against the Husky secondary, against a college secondary. This is your quarterback? Justin Herbert was not good in this game.
He wasn't great. But he also was playing, you know what? He was playing a very good defense. Not as good as the offense.
Not to hear you tell it.
Nonetheless.
God.
Because you know what? The Huskies actually improved offensively in this game. They're all the way up to 12th in FBI efficiency on offense.
It's so 25th frustrating. 25th on defense. College football is fun in a lot of ways, but the fact that this game means that they're eliminated from playoff contention is bullshit. And that's why there should be an 8 or 12 team playoff. Because the best teams do not go to the playoff every single year.
But they're not one of the four best teams in the country. You can't make an credible argument that UW is one of the four best teams in the country.
I'm biting my tongue about that.
You can make a credible argument for that?
Sure.
Then why are they not four in the top four in any like statistical metric?
Where are they at in the statistical metrics?
I mean, they're 8th in FPI.
Great. Make it an 18 playoff.
I mean, sure, but...
Maybe they're not in the top four. But was Georgia in the top four before this week?
Yeah, probably.
And they got destroyed by LSU.
They're down to 7th in Sagarin, apparently.
The Huskies are?
No, it's Georgia.
Georgia.
Huskies also 8th in Sagarin.
It's after that loss, though.
I suppose.
College football's stupid and I hate it. But the frustrating thing is Coach Pete is a good coach. And, like, you can't really complain about him because he's the one who got the team into this position to begin with.
I mean, you know, I thought about bringing back from last year the wouldn't trade Coach Pete for anybody, but acronym.
There's some people we'd trade Coach Pete for.
Who?
Well,
Nick Saban?
Yes, Nick Saban.
Wouldn't do it.
You would definitely.
No. Coach Pete's holistic view of the sport of football is much preferable to Nick Saban's more narrow-focused view that doesn't allow for off-the-field interests.
You would trade Coach Pete for Nick Saban.
Mm. Not my coach.
Okay. I mean, have fun losing this game to Oregon.
I mean, I'd rather not lose this game to Oregon, but...
Well.
Again, I think Coach Pete could hire like someone to help him with math. Like that could happen.
I don't know how much of this is on Bush Hamden or how much is on Coach Pete. But you know what? Let's have.
I mean, it was interesting. His comment today was in his Monday press conference was, with hindsight, I would have called a timeout and discussed the play with Bush. So it sounds like it wasn't really about Bush Hamden. It sounds like it
was what the hell? Well, let's just have a growth-based mindset here and assume that Chris Peterson, as that ball was sailing wide right, learned what he did wrong.
I mean...
And the next time that the situation comes up, maybe he'll run some more fucking plays and get the Huskies into a better position or try to score a touchdown there instead of relying on the kicking game. They could have scored a touchdown in the series.
It's very possible. It would have been more risky than just trying to advance the ball.
I'm so sick of this worry about risk. Like, what is the percentage of risk of a turnover versus a missed field goal?
Probably lower. Oh, definitely.
That's the thing, is like coaches only think in the sense of like
extending the game.
The ultimate risk. So there's this extreme risk of a turnover vis-a-vis the risk of missing the field goal. You should be looking at what maximizes your percentage chance of winning the game.
Yeah.
Not what the worst case scenario is. Because you could botch a snap on a field goal.
But again,
there's risk to doing anything.
Trying like throwing a pass to the end zone and kicking the 37-yard field goal aren't the only options. Because there's also trying to kick like a 31-yard field goal.
I'm not saying that they should have thrown a pass to the end zone. They should have just run their offense and tried to score.
All right.
It was third and one. You run a run play.
Third and run.
Yeah. third and run. That's what I call it most of the time.
Not in the NFL. Not in the NFL.
I think, isn't that one of the situations you're supposed to run the ball? They should have spread it out, given the ball to Sean McGrew, let him pick up 5 yards, and then maybe even run a run play after that.
Okay.
You agree, right?
Yeah.
It's devastating to watch. Football's the worst.
So now Colorado. The Huskies host the Buffaloes this weekend, who had I don't know if I would say more devastating loss at USC, because it certainly wasn't as frustrating. It was just like they knew early on that they were outclassed. Colorado, despite coming into that game undefeated and atop the Pac-12 South with 7-point underdogs at USC, and the odds makers proved prescient on that one. USC dominating the first three quarters.
Have the top make the top 25.
Yeah, they should. It really should. Colorado then staged a late comeback, but it was too little and far too late. The Buffs come into this one ranked 50th in ESPN's Football Power Index, 27th on offense, 50th on defense, and 87th on special teams, where they rank one spot ahead of the Huskies. Junior quarterback Steven Montez is completing 70% of his passes, but had just 170 yards on 47 attempts versus USC. For much of the first half, he was averaging, I think, under 3 yards a completion.
There you go. He's in Derek Carr territory.
Really was not looking deep in this one. And that's despite the fact that at that point, he still had their leading threat, Laviska Shenault, who leads all Pac-12 receivers with 60 catches and 780 yards. He's nearly 200 yards ahead of Aaron Fuller, who is second in the Pac-12 in receiving yardage. But Shenault later left this game with a toe injury, his status TBD for Saturday. The Colorado could
because
really
of course
use him.
College football injury reports.
Yeah. I mean, they also probably just don't know because it's Monday and the game's not until Saturday. Colorado could really use him, I would say, in this one. I'm concerned about Montez as a running threat. He had 11 carries for 81 yards and 2 touchdowns against UCLA a couple weeks ago. And it really felt like the Colorado offense got going in the fourth quarter when Montez started looking to run, kind of similar to Russell Wilson back in the day when Russell Wilson was able to run.
I remember those days.
Yeah. You know, besides that, generally, like, this is a game that the Huskies at home should win and should win comfortably. They are 17-point favorites.
The thing about the Husky offense, like, in that game against Oregon, a tough first half, but really got it together in the second half.
I mean, Jake Browning in third and fourth quarters, not in the overtime drive necessarily, but was basically perfect in the third and fourth quarters.
Have we heard anything about the status of either Miles Gaskin or Savon Ahmed?
They are both week-to-week questionable for this Saturday.
The Huskies should win this game with Sean McGrew.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, the Colorado is a pretty good rush defense. So this is a week for Jake Browning to kind of carry the load on offense,
it's
I would say.
More Aaron Fuller action.
But then Oregon was a good rush defense, and the Huskies ran the ball very successfully in that game. Averaged 4.3 yards per carry overall, but Kamari Pleasant went for 7.5. McGrew ended up only at 3.8. 5.5 for Savon Ahmed, including a 25-yard touchdown for him.
So sad.
Chances of victory?
80%. 85%.
Yeah, you're underselling it. FBI says 90% in this game. I'm going to go 85% to become conservative, but again, the Huskies should win.
I don't see the Huskies coming out in this game after that loss to Oregon and not really beating Colorado badly.
I think if they could play today, they would definitely do it.
We're gonna get there to the stadium and we'll be like 5 minutes late and the Huskies will have already scored a touchdown. That's a prediction. The Huskies will have scored a touchdown before we get to our seats.
Can we try to just get to our seats on time?
Morning tailgate.
Postgate.
The postgate's never good. Yeah. Nothing good ever happens at a postgate.
So speaking of winning easily, your Seattle Seahawks went to London and dominated the Oakland Raiders,
there we go.
Winning 27-3 in what was nominally a road game, but effectively a home game when you account for the dominance of the home Seattle, the Seahawks crowd there. We'll talk to Third Pelton brother Chris about that when he's next on the pod, is our London correspondent. Really a dominant performance from the Seahawks in every way, led 20-0 after three quarters. Oakland did get the late field goal to avoid the shutout.
Love that field goal. Yeah. Field goal attempt.
This game never particularly in any question, as the Seahawks dominated from start to finish. And their most lopsided victory, you have to find the most lopsided victory before this, you have to go all the way back to week 4 of the 2017 season when they beat Indianapolis 46-18 at home.
Wow, that was 46-18.
I think so.
I was trying to think about...
I'm doing that off the top of my head, but I looked that up yesterday.
Wow, off the top of your head.
Off the dome.
I was trying to think about when was the last time that we felt like the Seahawks offense in particular, but really the game in general, like the Seahawks dominated a team this much in a game. And in particular, like the Seahawks offense felt like it had the kind of rhythm that it had in this game.
Yeah, and you were arguing that Indianapolis, well, the Seahawks offense having that kind of rhythm would probably be the Texans game last year.
That was a good one.
You were arguing the Colts game didn't count because that game was pretty close in the first half.
It was also against Jacoby Brissett.
The Colts, the Seahawks opening it up in the fourth quarter. You'd probably have to go back to Carolina in week 13 of 2016 when Earl Thomas got injured and the Seahawks ran for 240 yards in a 40-7 victory over the Panthers.
That's what I was trying to think. I'd feel like
intercepted Derek Anderson on the opening play of the game.
This was the Raiders at more or less full strength. There were some injuries on the offensive line, but this wasn't like...
They didn't seem to miss Kelechi Assemble.
This wasn't...
Not that he would have been
Jacoby
blocking
Brissett,
Frank Clark.
Or the Panthers playing with Derek Anderson.
Well, Derek Anderson only played the one play.
Oh, he played the one...
Because Cam Newton got benched.
He was going to the game.
And they threw an interception on the first play.
Oh, my God. So good.
Ron Rivera, thanks for that one, buddy.
Yeah, I'm trying, like, looking back, there was even that domination against the Rams that they won. I think that was a Thursday night game, 24-3, and the game that Jared Goff missed, like, a wide open receiver in the end zone.
That was the John Ryan fake punt game?
Panthers game was the last time. Wow, there were some ugly losses that year. They lost 14-5 to the Buccaneers. This was a good team. Good God, that was a rough year. When you look at a game that dominant, it's been a while, I guess I'll say.
Yeah.
So my question for you is, after playing close with the Rams, who granted the Rams, we don't know how much the weather affected them in Denver. The Rams appear to be, I would describe, as slightly weakened.
I mean, their offense played much worse. Their defense performed better.
We probably know that the Rams defense is not like one of the top five defenses in the league.
Yeah.
So after a close game with the Rams and after going to London and really thumping the Raiders, beating them so thoroughly, with the Seahawks now sitting at 3-3, how do you feel about the team going into the bye week?
So I feel like the expected outcome for the season now, like 2 weeks ago after Earl Thomas was injured, I was down to 6 wins in terms of my expected win total. Now I'm between 8 and 9 wins.
Okay.
The Football Outsiders playoff projections have the Seahawks finishing with 8.5.
Okay.
With about
somewhere between 8 and 9.
Yeah, with a 44% chance of making the playoffs. And that's, I think, way better than anyone could have hoped 2 weeks ago. The defense has played reasonably well without Earl Thomas. I mean, much more so last week against Oakland than against the Rams. And I think we have to ask the question, is Shoddy good?
No, we don't. We don't have to ask
We have
question.
To ask the question. That was a really good offensive performance.
Russell Wilson is good.
I don't dispute that, but the Seahawks ran for 37 times for over 4 yards per carry. They ran a successful screen pass.
Oh, my God. Okay, do you want to know what made that screen pass successful? I've told you this every single week of the season, basically. Do you want to know what made that screen pass successful?
Was it play action?
It was play action.
Of course it was play action.
And the reason that Shoddy appears to be good is because, as I have said, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're running the ball better, therefore they use more play action. And that play action on that Rashad Penny screen pass was beautiful.
It was incredible. I mean, look, they've ran the ball really well and used play action really well and not been able to hit that screen pass ever before. Rashad Penny, also your leader in terms of yards per carry, aside from Tyler Lockett in this game, at 4.8 yards per carry. You got nothing for that one?
That's cool.
It was exciting to see Doug Baldwin back in the offense. Like, definitely, like, force-feeding Doug Baldwin.
It was just a fun game to watch in general.
David Moore just catches touchdowns like crazy and then high-pointing that ball on the sidelines.
There was only the one series.
Tyrone Swoops with a big catch?
Oh, that Tyrone Swoops catch.
Swoops, there it is.
Probably should have not. False start. There was only one series where the Seahawks really shot themselves in the foot and because of penalties that they probably should have scored on, the type of series that it feels like we've seen for so many times that gets you, like I said, out of rhythm, to use coach speak or whatever. But like they consistently, what was the third down conversion rate on this game?
They were 9 of 13.
9 of 13, and it was because picking up, and granted they had some short third downs or whatever. That's the other thing. Okay, and these
were
all
able to use read option on the short third downs?
Yeah. Also, self-fulfilling prophecy, the quick passing on third down with players who, get this, ran beyond the first down marker. Like, all of these things are things that are in the offense that they just don't do because they tell themselves they can't do them. And they did them in this game, and it worked.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of supposedly Mike Martz back in the day, when at the beginning of the Greatest Show on Turf Rams era, it was like, what if we just took all these plays we were saving them from third down and ran them all the time?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that was a great idea. Why didn't anyone else think of that? The other thing we haven't talked about yet, the Seahawks pressuring Derek Carr.
Oh, so good.
More importantly, the Seahawks dominating a Tom Campbell offensive line was so much fun to see.
Oh, man.
6 sacks in this game, 2.5 for Frank Clark, despite the fact that he only played limited snaps due to, I believe, a stomach ailment. 1 sack for Jaron Reed, 1 sack for Brandon Jackson, 1 sack for Shamar Stephen, 0.5 for Quentin Jefferson. Somehow, amazingly, not credited for a sack was Jacob Martin, but he was in the mix all game, providing a lot of pressure off the edge. Came up with a fumble recovery on the fumble forced by, according to this, Jaron Reed. But I thought that for sure that was Frank Clark, so I don't. That definitely was Frank Clark.
And the biggest upset of the day, nobody could have seen it, but you not tweeting anything in British slang.
Yeah, I was too in the moment and busy taking care of your 10 to 15 children. It was tough for me to get any tweets out.
Sorry. You're welcome, world.
Oh, man, I just realized I missed. You tweeted about Devin Moore only catches touchdowns. There was maybe like a David Moore, Roger Moore thing in there, like a Bond thing.
You're welcome. Again, you're welcome. I saved you from whatever that was. Did they pick off Derek Carr in this game?
They did not pick off Derek Carr. Just forced the fumble.
So, I mean, turnovers aren't
necessarily... Forced 2 fumbles, rather.
Aren't necessarily predictable or whatever, but there weren't any sort of, like, we'd consider cheap turnovers, like a takeaway off a batted ball or something like that. This was just a thoroughly dominant defensive performance.
It was. I mean, Oakland averaged 3.3 yards per play in this game. They were under 200 total yards of offense.
And again, Derek Carr is basically a backup who happens to be making whatever. How many millions is he making per year?
8th in DVOA coming into this game.
Nah, DVOA needs to rethink its formula.
QBR definitely took the W on this one. DVOA took the L. Did you answer how you're feeling about the rest of the season?
I can't say, because I'm always too optimistic.
Are you?
When I'm not extremely negative, I'm too optimistic.
You had a lot of clarity about this past weekend, including I have to take the L. I thought there were going to be a lot more Raiders fans there than Seahawks games. I said that on last week's pod. I was dramatically incorrect on that.
I'm going to say that.
Shouts to the 12s on that one.
I was right about my... I mean, have the Raiders been to London before?
I don't know.
I was writing about. This is the Seahawks' first time playing in London.
That is probably
a fact. It makes sense that people would have kind of waited to have gone to this game.
And especially European fans who don't normally have a chance to see the Seahawks play in person.
If I could have some clairvoyance about this next week, I just feel like they're probably not even going to play.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. What a hot take. They're just going to take the week off. Really rest on their laurels. I could come up with a sports reporters-esque take about this.
About how they lose to BYE or whatever. You know, God, that's like great joke for your grandfather.
Yep. The other thing we haven't talked about, DJ Fluker. He's like really good at football, it turns out.
At least run blocking. I mean,
you look at the Giants offensive line, and you think maybe DJ Fluker was holding the whole thing together last year.
Maybe it was Mike Solari and DJ Fluker holding the whole thing together.
Just plugging holes in that dam.
We're probably a little bit too positive about this game. And the Raiders are probably very bad.
But the Raiders played other games. They weren't this bad in any of their other games.
I truly believe that the Seahawks defense is pretty good, though. And the offense, when run the right way, can be a good offense.
I'm actually more skeptical of the defense than you are. And maybe more skeptical of the defense than the offense, weirdly.
So going into the bye, some interesting things with regards to injuries. Fortunately, the Seahawks, I'm going to knock on wood here, came out of this week relatively injury-free from that game. There was the kind of mysterious Nick Vanette injury that kind of came back and kept him out of the game. But as you look forward to week 8 when they go at Detroit, in what's a pretty crucial game for the season.
Yep.
You could have Ed Dixon making his first appearance of the season, most likely will.
Yep.
KJ Wright back.
Seems reasonable.
Nick Vanette healthy.
Deion Jordan.
Deion Jordan hopefully back. Basically everybody who's not out for the season could be healthy. Rasheem Green is another one.
I mean, J.D. McKissic would be another one who's not out for the season but could return at some point midway through the year.
J.D. McKissic is the only question mark, but also you're looking at, you're like, yeah, three pretty capable running backs.
I don't think J.D. McKissic can. He's not eligible yet. He's not eligible until at least week 9.
So you could be looking at a pretty healthy defense.
Yeah.
I mean, Austin Kalitro has done a very good job filling in. Barkevious Mingo has done a very good job filling in at linebacker, but throwing KJ Wright into that mix would be pretty nice. Adding Rasheem Green to the defensive line rotation, plus Deion Jordan would be pretty nice.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a team that, you know, we talked about the next good Seahawks team will look wildly different than the last good Seahawks team. And it's only really been a year, 2 years. But this team looks kind of wildly different than the last Seahawks team. And we have to get a little bit familiar with new names and new faces.
I mean, I think the one thing is the schedule isn't necessarily getting much easier after the bye week, despite the fact that they've played four of their first 6 on the road. You know, the teams they're going to be playing at home are generally very good. The Chargers, the Packers, you're not going to include the 49ers in that group. Vikings still a little iffy, but the Chiefs certainly in that group. And then road games coming up against the Rams and the Panthers, two likely playoff teams. But after November 11th.
Are a likely playoff team?
Yeah, I think they're a likely playoff team. I don't know what their Football Outsiders odds are. After they play at the Rams in L.A. on November 11th, they will have 2 remaining road games and 5 remaining home games. 5 of their last 7 at home for their last 5.
I'll be curious to see when DVOA comes out this week, but I think the Seahawks are a top 10 team at that point.
Based on Dave, I would say probably just a little bit outside that, because we did get a sneak preview of that in the playoff odds.
And they looked like they were like 11 or 12?
I mean, they were plus 6.0%, so that's just kind of my guess at it from looking at that in the past. Anything else on this week?
It feels good.
How frustrating is it to see that Kevin King interception?
Whatever, we've got 2 good corners.
It's true.
We've got 2 good young corners. Kevin King would also be a good young corner. But, you know, like Malik McDowell's out there crushing people on the D-line, so.
Too soon. Well, really the reason that any of the Seahawks discussion is possible, as we alluded to earlier, is the late Paul Allen, who passed away Monday at age 65. Allen purchased the Blazers in 1988 and then announced on draft day 1996 that he had purchased an exclusive option to buy the Seahawks from Ken Behring, who had attempted to move the team to LA earlier that spring. So he had that through July 1997 as they worked to come up with a new arena, a new stadium to replace the King Dome. And during the interim, one of the things I really remember is in early memory of the Paul Allen era is the 1997 draft where they took Sean Springs and Walter Jones both among the top 6 picks. And the only reason they were able to do that is because Paul Allen, even though he hadn't purchased the team yet, agreed with Ken Behring that he would pay the bonuses for those 2 players because of the logic, look, if I do buy this team, I don't want to have missed out on these talents because of the fact that I was unwilling to pay the bonuses.
Pretty insane year also.
Yeah. And two guys who were fixtures, cornerstones for the Seahawks for the next years to come. You're still wearing your Sean Springs jersey.
Absolutely, I am.
And Walter Jones, one of the most iconic players in the history of the franchise. June 1997, King County voters do in fact approve the referendum funding construction of CenturyLink Field, and on July 1st, 1997, Allen exercised that option to buy the Seahawks. And it's been a really impressive 20-plus year run here for him as owner of the Seahawks. I think, you know, particularly in the NFL, he's been everything you want an owner to be. Supportive, willing to do whatever it takes financially, but also largely hands-off, willing to hire the best people and let them do their job. That was first Mike Holmgren, and, well, that didn't necessarily go ideally in terms of having him in the dual coach GM role once he was back to strictly being the coach, a great run of success, and then now again with Pete Carroll and John Schneider. And, you know, I hesitate to think of how you could possibly have had a better owner over the stretch than Paul.
Well, and same for the Blazers also, right?
I mean, it was a little more meddlesome, I would say, on the Blazers' side. And it's interesting, you look at the timing of this, it actually was when he had previously battled cancer that there was a lot of turnover among Blazers' general managers. Kevin Pritchard getting let go. Then after that, Rich Cho's brief tenure. But then since they landed Neil Olshey, you've had the stability of Olshey and Terry Stotts for a long period of time here. And, you know, in Portland, he had the legacy of building the Moda Center, privately financed there. Was still one of the nicer arenas in the NBA. And, you know, that's a franchise that for a long period of time has operated financially like a large market club, despite being in a relatively small market.
And I think that's what I was thinking as far as kind of the legacy goes, is that when Paul Allen has been the owner, both of the Seahawks and the Blazers, you feel like you're in relatively good hands.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
He's someone who's definitely not sought out media attention. You mentioned him raising the 12th man flags before the NFC Championship games. That's basically the only time that, maybe hoisting the trophies, the only time you really saw Paul Allen as a fan. He was very content to be in the background, let other people take the spotlight and the credit. And that's, you know, again, what you'd want in an owner.
And throughout his Seahawks tenure, the team has been very good some of the time, pretty good a lot of the time, really bad almost never.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and there's only so much credit control you have over that as an owner. But again, in terms of putting the right people in place, doing what you can as an owner, he has done it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's done the most that he can. Being willing to spend the money at the right times for both of the organizations, being willing to go out and get Pete Carroll a year after recognizing that maybe Jim Mora wasn't the right coach for the team, going to USC and getting one of the most coveted coaches in all of college and bringing Pete Carroll here, and then eventually landing the Seahawks' first Super Bowl win.
I'd also, in terms of putting the right people in place, add Todd Lewicki to that group, who's now, of course, part of the NHL Seattle group, overseeing his brother's vision for, you know, bringing the NHL to Seattle to play in the renovated new arena at Seattle Coliseum, Seattle Center, rather. You know, he was tremendous in that role and also was instrumental in bringing Pete Carroll to Seattle.
The most amazing thing about Paul Allen is that as a billionaire, it seems like he lived his life closest to the way that I would as a billionaire.
you're beginning to make it out.
Just sort of. Like, he had some fun. He didn't seem like he hated being a billionaire.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, also you talk about his impact above and beyond sports. The way that Vulcan managed South Lake Union has, for better or worse, shaped the future of Seattle for decades to come. His donations to cancer research, and particularly the Allen Neuroscience Institute, what they're doing in terms of trying to understand how the brain works. I mean, those are going to be the kind of impacts that he's going to have that are going to, you know, be his lasting legacy, I think, you know, not just in Seattle, but in the world.
I've been told by multiple people that he shreds on guitar.
That has been out there.
So,
I mean, so just really, really a tremendously disappointing day. I mean, you know, we knew this was a possibility with the return of his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but I don't think anyone thought it would happen this suddenly.
And we hope that whomever is next taking over both of these organizations runs them in a similar way to his vision and really kind of respects the organizations that he's built.
Yeah, and I mean, those questions are kind of inevitable because of the fact that, you know, there wasn't an obvious succession plan. Allen doesn't have a family, never married, never had children. So it's tough to say what happens. But, you know, really, I think those questions should not be in the forefront today. Really, today and the next few days here are about remembering Paul Allen's legacy and everything he meant to the city of Seattle and particularly sports fans here. So, you know, I think definitely thanks are in order to Paul Allen for, you know, everything he's meant to us.
On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.